Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 18 Summer Show. We are your hosts, Jim
and Jamie Shields. We're here to help you bring family back.
In the last decade, we've helped thousands of families create the family life that you have always wanted.
We give you simple solutions on how you can ignite your family life and succeed in both business and at home.
And please remember, time is of the essence. You only have 18 summers to truly connect with your children.
So let us help you make the most of it.
Hey, 18 Summers Tribe. Jim back here. Jamie's not going to be joining us today, but a very good friend of mine is going to be joining, my friend and confidant in many of things, Eric Kerr. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my buddy before we get started. I'm really excited today because I know what we'll talk about, not only family, but around the subject of addiction is something that has been brought up to me and Jamie countless times. And no one knows that field better than Eric, as far as I'm concerned. So my friend Eric, over the last 30 years, he's founded several companies, worked and advised leading experts in Fortune 100 companies. He was also the founder of DrawShop, which we've personally used. It's the whiteboard animation company, first one that was dedicated to helping businesses globally, 100 different languages. If you ever went to certain sports games and you saw them up during the seventh inning stretch or at different times, that was Eric's company. Pretty cool stuff. He was the founder and organized the very first global summit dedicated to the topic of addiction, which is what we'll talk a lot about today. The Healing Addiction Summit had over 30,000 attendees. Jamie and I were part of it, I'm proud to say, and it's become a leading expert all over the globe. He's authored four programs now on healing addiction and trauma, and his new company, LifeTrack, is running the very first, and this is really cool, IRB-approved research study with tech partners on a ring that you put on your finger to produce the first algorithm that will help predict and prevent crisis state addiction and relapses using biotechnology. And let me tell you, I didn't understand the tie-in of relapse and addiction until Eric, and he's the one who's taught me this. And it's just incredible what they're doing. The inmate population they're working with prisoners also for long-term reintegration of released prisoners to help lower relapse, reducing a $65 billion cost to our economy. Relapse is very expensive, not only financially, but obviously emotionally and relationally to so many people. Well, the first thing I wanted to talk about, just knowing our personal lives together, You and your lovely wife, Anitra, who has hosted us before at your house, you guys have been married 30 years. Mm-hmm. And you're still a young man. You guys got married young, have had a successful marriage. And I love to see that. That inspires me and Jamie to be married long-term. And you've always been someone I've looked up to on that. So I just wanted to ask you a question of, you know, what contributes to long-term relationship success? And you guys have four sons. You know, what has really kept you and Anitra strong?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, obviously it's her being very patient. And I always tell people that, you know, when you marry up, she's more of, you know, a service person. She's committed somehow in the pre-heaven world to, you know, be with me so that to make sure that I got into heaven, because I wouldn't be able to make it in without her. She does enough good to make up for all my mistakes and all my craziness.
There you go.
But, you know, it's interesting when you first get married and you go through these phases, like the first 7 years and then you're to 14 years. And all of a sudden you wake up, you're at 21 years. And now we're, you know, we're rolling into 30 years and everything is a little bit different. It's kind of like climbing a mountain where you have, you know, the landscape is different. The higher you go, the more you can see all around you. And you have larger perspective, the higher up you go. And I kind of see marriage as the same way.
Okay.
You know, when you start, you know, for example, when I was climbed Kilimanjaro with my son, you start out in this very dense kind of rainforest and it's foggy and you can't see very far. And the higher up you go, the trees and the landscape starts to change, things start to open up. And then when you're at the summit, you can see everything. And, you know, I think that just using that analogy, marriage is very much kind of a journey. And you know, when you go and you climb anything, that, you know, where you start is not where you're going. And I think from my perspective now, you can see if you have a longer term perspective in terms of, you know, this is something that we're committed to go through together for a long time. It's not always going to be easy. And you certainly make a lot of mistakes along the way. But I think open communication, trust, also letting the person be who they are. You know, a lot of times we are tempted to confine our partners to the way we think they should behave and the way that we think they should treat us, and make it all about us, where, you know, you want them to thrive and feel important and have value as well. And then that's what you end up trying to do with your kids as well. So I think that's kind of, you know, what our secret has been. She's always been very open and honest with me about how she feels about things.
Yeah,
and
which is great, right? Because some people are totally closed off to do that.
Yeah, but it gives you an opportunity to confront and work through it.
Yeah,
she has been very, very tolerant and forgiving of, you know, the entrepreneurial life. I mean, there are stages where, like, we couldn't afford to put carpet in, and we had like the what do you call those carpet staples with the teeth coming out on our stairs for like 2 years.
Yeah.
Well, that, you know, because I couldn't afford to put carpet in. She was like, it's all good. I know we're gonna work it out and we can get through this. So,
which I think is key right there. And you kind of say that very subtly, but I think that's extremely powerful, because most divorces have a financial element from what a lot of people say. And I know you and I have had great discussions where it is, entrepreneurship is not that line going up. I mean, there are peaks and big valleys that you and I have been in where, like you said, like, things go really dry, things get tough, like, you got to hang on. And to have an understanding of that is absolutely key. You know, I know, I'm sure you've taught your boys, and I know I speak to that as saying, who will be there not only in the peaks, but in the valleys. And, you know, I think, like you had told, you know, with stories of us of building the businesses and setbacks, to have a spouse that will stand by you in those is absolutely key. And you've seen that.
Yeah. And outside of the typical things, which are, you know, very hard to overcome, as, you know, couples, you know, I think just having that understanding of, no matter what comes, like, I'm here with you and we're going to work it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and having that long-term perspective and not a short-term transactional perspective.
Yeah. Well, and what I love to see too, and this is something I think you and I share, is I want to be a successful entrepreneur, but I wanted to make impact. So you in many different businesses, and then, you know, Draw Shop, which went really big, you parlayed it forward into addiction. You know, I've tried to do the same thing from real estate to family, but I watched you, and it has been so cool to watch from the inception, just the ideas of this thing of addiction, you know, and I just, tell me, you know, what's happening? What, I mean, you've told me some stories about just, you know, I remember your dad was sick, and you got the idea of, and it wasn't anything drug related, when someone could monitor the heart. Just like, let's go back to, I mean, you've always had a passion for helping addicts, which is really cool. But I love that story about how you actually started to think about this ring. Do you remember telling me that story about your sister and your father?
Well, it wasn't even the ring at that point, you know, and it's not specifically tied to the ring. The Aura Ring is a technology partner that we have that, you know, is fundamentally, I'm wearable agnostic. It's just, you know, what is going to give us the best data to measure what we're trying to measure, right? And Aura Ring has been a tremendous technology partner for us, and they've been very supportive, and they've opened up their staff and their resources to us, and became a part of this study. But there was a time, I don't know, maybe 6 years ago, when my sister and I were playing cards with my father, and my sister's a registered nurse, has been for, you know, her whole career. And so while we were playing, my father's hand started dropping, right? And he started dropping cards and stuff. And so she started doing things to, like, hey, let's everybody move their cards to the left hand, and let's, you know, let's lay down the cards at the same time. So she started testing Dad fundamentally for stroke to see if he was having stroke. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, she goes, Dad, you're having a stroke. So I'm going to call 911. And I didn't know he was having a stroke. He didn't realize he was having a stroke. And so because she knew what the indicators are, she could predict that this was happening, right? Because she could see it in real time. So what I took from that experience was fundamentally, we're, if you look at things that we manage from a crisis state, which is addiction relapse or, you know, suicide, as another example that we're starting to get into as well. Like there are precursors and indicators that the brain and the body are saying, here we come, you know, like a train whistle down the track, the bars go down and then you're not going to get on the track. My assumption was all that is available through the brain and the body. We just need to be able to identify what those markers are. And then we can do what we need to do before we're in the ditch, right? To stay on the road.
Well, I think that's so, and I want to stress this because I didn't understand the importance until you sat me down and talked to me about it. But I don't think people understand the importance of catching relapse. Because again, no bigger, I think one of the biggest fears of all parents is addiction and suicide. And these two things can go together. But I did not understand how just strong the relapse numbers were and what can happen. And the fact that you focused on the relapse was huge. And I think parents have to realize relapses are a very serious thing. It's not just addiction. But it's the, if they start to get help, the relapses can be extremely dangerous and go down that bad road. And until, from what I've seen from your efforts, there were lots of groups focusing on getting help, the classic rehabs. But I mean, what did you tell me the amount of relapses were for the average rehabilitation? A kid goes to rehab. What was
I mean, most people relapse 85%. Actually, it's closer. It's between 85 and 90% of people who go to, you know, quote unquote, or not even quote unquote, but detox centers, right, to get clean will relapse, almost guaranteed. Right. And the reason for that is all the environmental factors, the smells, the thoughts, the person's face that you see. The car that you got high in, you know, whatever the case is. And it could be, I mean, this could be food addiction. This could be sex addiction. There's all kinds of different addictions, right? But fundamentally what your brain has been programmed to over time is to drive to that reward, because that reward gives satisfaction, calm and peace and happiness. And in other words, it gives you that dopamine boost. So in detox, you get clean, but you don't rewire your brain, right? That takes time. So you're not healed, you're clean, but you're not healed. So when people go back into, so that's why when people go on like a 14 or a 30 day hardcore, you know, I want to lose 25 pounds, they change everything about, essentially they go into detox, food detox. Yes. So they change everything about how they're doing things. Mm-hmm. But then when it's over, they mark check, right? 20 pounds lost. But then they go back in their same habits and routine again. And so it's really just the brain learning, you know, oh, I see Jim's face, or I smell this, or I look at that car, or I'm in this part of town, right?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the brain starts waking up and going, hey, I want to drive you to this behavior. And what we know about addiction now is that the dopamine kind of reward doesn't happen at the transaction. It happens, it's leading you to that transaction, right? So let's say you went downtown, and then downtown you went to a specific block, and on that block you smelled like that burger joint that was on that block, and that's where you got your you know, supply.
Your fix, yeah.
So what'll happen is you drive downtown, let's say just to go to a store, right? The brain will go, oh, we're in this area. And then before you know it, kind of your blinders start to go in, and it'll give you that dopamine hit that you're in that area. And then it will connect the next memory, which is, oh, remember that block over there? And then before you know it, you're starting to turn the car and you're driving, it's, oh, I'm going to go this way. You almost don't even realize you're doing it. Right. And then, you know, so that, and then when you turn and you go to that block, you get another dopamine hit. And then when you smell that burger joint, you get another dopamine hit. So it's driving you to that very specific location and transaction and person is what your brain doing. And then when you take the drugs, you don't get the hit anymore. The brain is driving you to the transaction.
Wow.
Right. And it's so powerful that my friend Susan Thompson, who owns Bright Line Eating, she suffers from food addiction. And she said, you know, what addiction is when you have a food addiction and you're shoving donut after donut in your mouth and you're sobbing because you know that that's not what you should be doing while you're doing it. But you continue to grab the donut.
And would you say it's in from your experience in this, this is when I used to see it when people would go away to get help. It seems like from what you've shown me over the years, probably 90% of the rehabilitation efforts, the addiction efforts out there are on that first 30 days, those 2 months, that detox period, but not the rewiring, not the reworking like you're talking about. There's not a lot out there for that, hence the large amount of relapses.
Yeah, and it's really not the fault of those locations, I don't think. I mean, although a lot of them are built just to be a very profitable center, because I mean, people pay $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 to go into these places for 30 days. Yeah. And then they come out, and the average person will go through, I mean, a lot of people have gone through detox, you know, centers like that, 10, 11, 12 times, and then the families end up paying for them. And there's always that constant like glimmer of hope that you're hoping things will go back to normal. But the system fundamentally is built very transactionally, yeah. Right? So one part of the journey doesn't have to do with the other part of the journey. And so when you go to a detox center and you go through detox, you're going home environment, mom, dad, everybody else is assuming, well, they're going to be okay because they were in detox and they don't change their support behaviors. But then let's say that they go to a detox center that teaches yoga, meditation, nutrition, supplementation. Well, they're going to go to a local support a local support outpatient program.
Yeah.
Which doesn't have any idea about any of that. And so all the training and all the kind of this is how you live your life is broken because it goes to another support center that is doing things very differently. It is more about just check in here, check in now. If you didn't check in, where are you? And so it's very complicated. And so what we did with the Sanctuary, who is our treatment partner in this pilot, is we changed the model. And we work together in changing the model from, okay, we're going to, when they come in for 30 days, we're going to assign them a ring. And then we're going to teach them all this. We're going to get them detoxed. But then we're going to support them through coaching and continuation of the ring and patterns and behaviors that they learned here for 60 days afterwards.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we started working with the Sanctuary, we said, do you know what your relapse rates are for people who go through? How successful is your program when they go home? They said, we have no idea because nobody will answer our emails when they go home.
Wow.
Right? And this is not a cheap one. It's a very good one. It's worth the money. But so what we've done now is we know that when they come through, here are the biometric data on sleeping pattern, heart rate variability while they're in. So we get baselines, and essentially we're teaching them how to use technology to monitor their own behaviors and their own health and their own sleeping patterns so they can establish those baselines. And then when they leave, they still have the Oura ring on. And one of the most basic indicators that we've been able to find is when somebody goes home and they take the ring off, something's going on.
Wow. So
that's what we know is. Yeah. So that's one of the most obvious indicators that we have, which is so simple, right? Like yeah. It's just like if your kids come,
anymore. I don't want this thing paying attention to me anymore.
Yeah. So what the staff will do is they'll reach out to them immediately because it's live feed, and they'll reach out via email, via phone, say, you know, what's going on? How come you took your ring off? Was there something going on? What that does is that leads to conversations about stress, shame, anxiety, perhaps a relapse, right? That they didn't want to have caught. But all these things are in the constant conversation now and supporting through that transition period, which is really difficult for people. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's not a question of whether you will or won't relapse, because you likely will, but not to the point where you're going to overdose and die. And that's where most people will die after a serious addiction like heroin. They go to detox, their systems are clean, they go use at the same level that they used before, but on a clean system, they die. So it's super exciting. We can identify now, based on heart rate variability and sleeping pattern, people who kind of go off the grid after they go home, we can see a very specific pattern in sleep rate and heart rate variability 6 days before they leave the center, which means that their anxiety around going home is starting to increase.
Yeah.
And, you know, so now we can see that, we can talk to them about it, and we can start addressing it.
Okay. That's incredible. I mean, when you think about it, that's accountability. I know in our business things, accountability was always key. Now it's giving accountability not only to the center, which wants to see them do well and give some mm-hmm. sort of follow-up support, but also I remember you saying you're even getting to the point where if they were feeling a certain way, it could trigger them to say, hey, call your sponsor. Hey, call your mother. It's like a safe person. So it can give them a little more ammunition to stave off a relapse. Where before it was just, they're kind of out there naked in the wind, right? And now this gives them something to lean on, some sort of direction when they're by themselves.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to be very clear and fair to the people who go through detox and are suffering from addiction. Like when you go through detox and you go home, there's a lot of, I mean, you're not reducing, the suffering isn't reduced, right? Just because you know what the mechanisms are. They're still going through a lot of pain. They're still going through a very high level of temptation because their brain is firing at them with like cannons to use again. And so this is something that has to be understood and respected on their part, saying like, I get this is really hard. Like we don't understand how hard it really is because it's a real thing. Right? The brain is a very, very powerful thing. So what you're looking to do is just kind of give them the mechanisms, the hope, you know, the communication, the contacts that will help them and assist them through that. Because the longer that they go without it, then the more success they're likely going to have. But the brain is so powerful that like they could be clean for 20 years and all of a sudden they smell that burger joint again. And then it will fire, you know, use. So what this does is it kind of debunks a little bit, or doesn't really debunk, but, you know, addiction is not a question of willpower after a certain point, perhaps in the beginning, like you weren't brave enough to tell your friend no, right? Or you shouldn't have gotten that car. So all those arguments can be had. But after a certain point, your brain is so fundamentally rewired. It's like telling somebody who's had a stroke, stop limping, right? Stop slurring your speech.
That's one of the best examples I've ever heard. I mean, you wouldn't say that. And I think that's the confusion around addiction. Stop hanging your arm down. Well, just had a stroke, you know? And as you said, the problem with addiction is a lot of it is interior. You're not gonna see a person whose like arm is a little bit limp and say, oh, they're an addict. That's not how it works. So it's so much interior brain. I think that puts some of the extra pressure on an addict because they could be standing there looking normal and we have no idea what they're going through. That's something that you taught me about the understanding. And I think the understanding is key. And man, I mean, thinking about, you know, what I've learned from you in the last few years compared to what I was learning in seventh grade, oh my gosh, like they had they didn't have any preparation to handle this kind of stuff. And
well, nobody had any data.
Yeah.
We didn't know.
Yeah. We were really feeling around in the dark when you think about it. And what's exciting is, although I think you'd be the one to tell me that I believe addiction numbers are up, especially through COVID, we also have more data. And as you said, we can go at it a completely different way. Not the, hey, straighten up, you're fine. that's not going to work, especially when there's powerful brain rewirings. We can equip it in different ways, which I
Yeah, I agree with you, Jim. And the thing that, we know now versus, you know, we probably wouldn't have known when, let's assume COVID happened when we were in, you know, seventh grade or eighth grade or ninth grade or whatever, right? The difference between then and now is addiction numbers are up, but we know why they're up.
Yeah.
We know that they're up because of isolation. We know that they're up because of stress around job loss. We know that, you know, relationships are being pressured, which goes back to kind of what Gabor Mate taught me and tells everyone is, you know, it's not why the addiction, it's why the pain.
Yeah.
Wow. Because addiction is fundamentally used to, as an escape mechanism.
Escape from pain. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Because food, most people are going to be addicted not to celery. Have you ever heard of anybody that's addicted to celery? Right. They're addicted to high sugar.
That's one.
Yeah, I know, right? Me too. Yeah. Yeah, they're addicted to, you know, caffeine. They're addicted to donuts. They're addicted to high sugar content. They're addicted to, you know, white flour that most of, you know, the foods are made up of. So, you know, the food organizations and the food industry spends a lot of money on the science, the neuroscience of food smells, food tastes, and so forth to trigger that dopamine hit.
Yeah. What do you think? And again, this is kind of a tough question, but I know people are out there thinking. So there's always parents, and we don't like to face our fears. And a fear, you know, you've been to our retreats before, our workshops. Addiction is a fear for parents. I think it's a legitimate fear. It has been for me, for I'm sure for your four children, my four. There's no guarantees around it. What do you think if someone had to say, if you had to kind of almost sum it up, and I know this is impossible, like what would be the number one thing that people could do to help reduce the chances or the odds of addiction with our children? What can we do to support them? We can't cure, we can't guarantee, but what could we do?
This is something that I think, and also I learned from Gabor and Dr. Shefali and so forth, is the most important thing you can do is strengthen that core relationship between yourself and the child. Because children fundamentally look for that really strong relationship. And if they don't have it with you, they'll go and try to have it with their friends, right? Which is super transactional. You know that, you know, youth suicide rates are up as well because, and the data is still coming out, but if you look at cell phone use and you probably know this, Jim, like, you know, social media use and everything, children are associating their value to the number of likes they have or, you know, how many views they get or how many friends they have on social media or, you know, who's being invited to what. And I mean, you look at these, there's news coming out like almost twice, multiple times a month of these huge TikTok stars who are committing suicide that are, you know, young, young kids who have 1 million, 2 million followers, but all of a sudden, for some reason, they get trollers on there and, you know, they could have 1 million people who love them, but it's the two or three that just say, you're not worth anything. You're an idiot. And you're ugly. And all of a sudden they're like, life isn't worth living anymore. So, but if you have a relationship with your child where they have that trust to come to you and say, listen, I'm hurting, or you have a relationship where you can see that something's going on and you know how to address that with your child, and that goes a really long way. Right.
Yeah.
We had, you know, one of our sons, we had a really hard time connecting with. And it wasn't until we said, no matter what you do, no matter where you go, home is home and we love you no matter what.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you can always tell us what's going on and we will not judge. And it took a little while for him to see that that's actually where we stood and we were going to follow through with that commitment. Yeah. But now it's, you know, it's amazing. And, you know, this is not, you know, this isn't, life is complicated. Children are complicated, right? You know, until they're 23, like they're back in the front of the brain are not even connected 100%, right? So it's a wild ride for sure. And there isn't like with each child, just do this and it's going to be the same result with each child. They're all fundamentally different. But what you can have that is the same is that connection of trust, that connection of support. and an environment where they don't feel like your love is predicated on a grade or their success in a sport or, you know, these kind of things, right? It's like, no matter what, it's kind of like grandma love. You have to have grandma and grandpa love with your child.
Unconditional, yeah. Yep.
Absolutely. But still be able to, you know, create those confines, which you have to do as a parent. So I'm not saying let them do whatever they want and it's okay. But that's my opinion. And that's what we've tried to do with our kids. And we have a really good relationship with our kids.
Oh, yeah. I've seen it. We've been around it. We've watched it. It's been inspiring.
But it hasn't always been that way. You know, when I was a young dad and each was a young mom, it was like, well, you're not behaving. So we need to write a contract, right? You're going to do this and this and this on a weekly basis, right? And if you do that, then great. Thumbs up. That was horrible. Like, that was terrible.
That doesn't work.
It didn't work at all.
Young, struggling entrepreneur, too, you are very committed to time. I mean, you spell love T-I-M-E. Like, you spend a lot of time, cool trips, preparing to climb mountains. And I think that alone is obviously a very strong core value we share in common. Mm-hmm. That I think if more people would realize that they can't substitute quality, then they can't delegate themselves out of this position. You're saying you have to do it. Counselors have a time and a place, but as you said, it starts at home. And that's something I want to commend you on, because I've watched you say, I'm going to climb this mountain with my sons. I'm going to do this. And it, you can't take that away. I'm going to ski. I'm going to, you know, and even when, you know, one of your sons had the health setbacks, you were so there. I mean, we talked about that at our retreats, and I just think that's an example that I've always seen as an offense and a defense for what we're talking about. So I just want to commend you on that. You know,
I appreciate that. So, you know, you have the board meetings, and I think too many times parents default to, you know, asking their kids if they want to do something. The kids are going to go, no, I'm good. Right. And then just like, well, at least I asked.
Yeah,
but you've experienced, and I've experienced, when you say no, we're gonna go. Like, I'll take my kids on a hike, and one of my sons are like, I hate hiking. But 20 minutes into a 4-hour hike, they're starting to talk. They're kind of over their attitude, and you're starting to have conversations about things that you love, right? And that they're being honest about, and they're asking questions about, and you know, it's just something about creating that environment where that's possible, and not saying I'm good, because almost every kid is going to say no, I'm good, or a lot of kids are, because they have gaming options, like, you know, computer options, they've got their phone, whatever.
Yeah, but it's our job to step in, and we've had that same experience. You know, my oldest son Alden, and him and Hayden are about the same age, and he would say, we went on one of our last board meetings, you know, and we do at the dinner table, best part of the day, weirdest part of the day. And he said, you know, the best part of the day was going out fishing with dad, just the two of us. And I really appreciate how he makes sure he gets time just with me. That's coming from a, you know, kind of stoic teen. So that from the mouth of teens comes truth, right? And again, more people with this simple principle, if they would just actually put it to work, even though they say they don't need it, even though it feels uncomfortable, I do think it's a starting point for sure.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. My dad actually did that with me towards starting in junior high. We used to, once a month, we would have a father-son outing, right? And then you didn't have cell phones or anything else. And we'd go hiking or canoeing on an overnight trip or something like that. And those were very important. The funny thing is, I have four sisters. He didn't deal with any of them. But I was also the biggest troublemaker, so he probably had that was probably his reasoning around the solution and the activities. But you know, very memorable. I still remember those. I felt deep connection. You know, the fact that he would put time aside meant a lot to me. You know, just funny things.
Stays with you. Well, hey, with staying with you, I want to finale with our famous question. I know I'm going to have you back on because I do want to talk about what you do for the prisons. Again, addiction and prisons are two things, prison reform and support. But today I want to just stick with family and addiction. I want to kind of highlight with our grabber question at the end. And really excited to actually hear it because I value your wisdom so much. So as you know, we all talk about what would you say to your 18-year-old self? And that's great. It's great advice, great exercise. But the last year, especially with all the craziness, I kept saying to myself, what would 75-year-old Jim say? What would, he's going to be older, wiser, what would he say? So what do you think 75-year-old Eric would say right now? What advice do you think he would give to you, to other people? You know, what do you think he would say?
Don't overreact. It's all going to work out.
Wow. Wow. How many 28-year-old entrepreneurs need to hear that, right? Like you and I.
Yeah,
yeah, that's beautiful. And it's so true. It's so true. That is a very, I mean.
Just kind of stay the course and stay the rhythm. I think fundamentally, if everybody looked at, you know, what they do, because there was a time when COVID happened when you're just kind of feeling like, okay, I need to serve and I need to go out and help. And we're kind of desperate to really just kind of keep those outer connections. But then what happened to me was like, I was starting to take on all that kind of weight of everybody else as well. And I didn't have capacity for my most important core, right? Which was my family, my wife, myself personally, my own personal health. So, you know, it's like Anitra was saying this morning, she goes, everything is just as it should be. Everything is just as it should be.
I love that.
Right. And so there's a lot of things that we just can't control. COVID, you can't control. But there's a lot of things that happen in life that are similar to COVID that we couldn't control. And we made it through those as well. Yeah. So, you know, you just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other and just don't stop.
I love it. I love it. Hey, bud, where can people learn more about you? I want, in case, because I know there's going to be people wanting to learn more. Is there a website we can direct to learn more about what you're working on or anything like that?
Yeah, lifetrack.com, LIFETRAQ.com. Okay. You know, that's really geared. We're going really heavy into supporting corrections right now and recidivism, which has got an 85%, you know, addiction rate, within the system, which is why we kind of went there. But, so, you know, if you're interested in reaching out or having a discussion, it's just e@lifetrack, LIFETRAQ.com. And you just shoot me an email.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I appreciate you. Jamie appreciates you. You've been a good friend to me for many years.
Oh, and you guys have too.
Yeah, and big fan of your whole family, as you know, and you've been so supportive of ours. So I appreciate you coming on today, sharing the wisdom about family, addiction. Obviously, two things very important that all families want to know more about and be better equipped for. So I really appreciate it. And, you know, I look forward to getting back together with you sooner than later.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, buddy. We'll talk to you soon then. Thanks for being on.
Love you guys.
Love you too, pal.